just 11:30 and we're starting on time with the why do we have a conceptual framework session. And I think we're very lucky to have Tom Scott and Andrew Leonard presenting this session. Tom has been a board member at the board for about 18 months. He joined in April of 2017. He came to the board from Canada, and in this case, he came to the board from Canada because he's worked in both sides of the country with an academic background, he's only had 1 year here, but I think is really done a tremendous job, especially bonding with the conceptual framework. He had a year to do that before we issued it, and I think he's excited to be here talking about it today with you. Andrew Leonard is from the UK Financial Reporting Council. Many of you know Andrew from his years involved in the standard-setting community, also perhaps from his work seconded to the ISB, where he worked on the conceptual framework. And I think from some preliminary conversation I heard, I think I will give the disclaimer for everybody involved that the views expressed today are views of individuals and their opinions on the conceptual framework, not necessarily the organizations that they represent. So many years thinking about the conceptual framework and how it relates to ours that we issued in March of 2018. Ready, steady, go.
Thank you, Mary. And may I say that I'd just like to start by thanking the IASB for the opportunity to present to you all this morning. It's a great privilege. It's also been a privilege to work together with Tom on this presentation, which has given me a chance to get him to get to know him a bit better. And we know there are many areas that we agree on, and some of the more recondite areas we perhaps disagree on, but perhaps we won't get too much into that this morning. Perhaps something that's worth thinking about is, we had the slides up there a few minutes ago, but sorry, I think we just got derailed by the evaluation of the previous session. Brilliant. What would the world be like, let's imagine, if there was no conceptual framework? Well, one might speculate about a few things. One is that the standards just wouldn't be as good. They would tend to reflect the collected beliefs and experiences of those who happen to sit around the standard setting table from time to time. And they would be, no doubt, excellent people and perfectly capable of coming up with informed judgments, but their judgments wouldn't always be consistent. Particularly as, of course, the membership of standard-setting bodies does change from time to time. So the standards would all be all over the place. They would also likely be heavily influenced by whatever issues were in the headlines in the weeks and months preceding the development of a standard, rather than necessarily based on a sounder foundation. And they would be influenced by self-interested groups who would spend time and resources to lobby them and explain why their proposed solutions didn't work. So essentially, the conceptual framework acts to focus a debate and try to keep it on a standard level. Now, fortunately, one doesn't just have to dream about this. This is not just my speculation or theory. I'm sure that many from many countries will have similar experience of their own, but I can tell you something about what happened in the UK. Standard setting before even I started in standard setting, would you believe? Back in the 1970s, we had a standard setting body of a kind. And its very first standard was on the subject of associated companies and equity accounting. Now, somebody pinched me book, so I couldn't actually go back and prove this, but I'm fairly confident that that was a response precisely to an accounting scandal at the time. There was a very large, prominent UK company that equity accounted for something in which it arguably, or certainly in the views of many, had no significant stake or not sufficient to justify equity accounting. So the newly formed standard-setting body was kind of bounced in to writing a rule. And essentially, we've still got the same rule today, because that's what standard setting does. It creates rules that persevere for a very long time. Now, fortunately, I'm not going to give you a lecture on deferred tax or on pension accounting. I did it in my time. But I would just flag up that, again, back in the 1980s, we had standards that were wildly inconsistent. We had a standard on deferred tax that gave a number in the balance sheet that, as David Tweedy would say, you could perhaps explain to your grandmother. I don't think it was the right answer, but it was sort of basically okay, or it could arguably be okay. The charge for tax expense in the profit and loss account made no sense whatsoever. And then the standard setting body, the Old Accounting Standards Committee, turned its mind to pension accounting. And it said, whoops, whatever we do, we've got to get a sensible number in the P&L account. And the cost of doing that was that we had a number in the balance sheet that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. Indeed, if a company had a deficit in its pension scheme, which today would be shown clearly as a liability, it could, in some circumstances, actually report an asset. Now, how anybody was supposed to make sense of financial statements that were prepared on such an inconsistent basis certainly escapes me. But now I'll turn to Tom to take you through what the conceptual framework actually does.
Good day, everyone. So, let me get the clicker device now. To pass it back and forth here. So nature and purpose of a conceptual framework. So Andrew started us off by saying, let's think of a world where there was no conceptual framework. And so I'm going to flip it around now a little bit and think a little bit about putting in the affirmative. What are the advantages to having a conceptual framework? And we kind of pulled two quotes. There are a lot of ways you could have started this, but we'll go through these two quotes. One was from the beginning of the FASB project in 76, and then another from the IFRS Foundation Constitution. And we'll look at these two as sort of starting points for why a conceptual framework's useful. I'll take the first one, and then Andrew will ultimately do more depth on the second. So, but I'll read through the two of them. So the first one, it says, a conceptual framework is a constitution, a coherent system of interrelated objectives and fundamentals that can lead to consistent standards and that prescribes the nature, function, and limits of financial accounting and financial statements. And I actually pulled an extra line from farther on that I particularly liked, or we pulled from, that we liked. A constant thread of reason, a basis for solution to guide standard setters. And then the IFRS Constitution, Constitution, it says to develop in the public interest a single set of high quality, understandable, enforceable, and globally accepted financial reporting standards based upon clearly articulated principles. And the clearly articulated principles should be found in a conceptual framework. So we put kind of in red these two kind of jumping off points. And so the FASB actually started with, they said a conceptual framework is a constitution, a really strong affirmation. I think most people would probably say it's like a constitution or this be a useful analogy. But I'm going to do it more from the point of view that it's a useful analogy. So we're going to talk a little bit, why did they make this analogy and why did they make it so strongly? And then on the second one, one big question is, they could have simply stopped the IFRS after financial reporting standards. why did they think they had to say based upon clearly articulated principles? And Andrew's going to pick that up. So just on the Constitution analogy, and I'll do it more from a national perspective, but it could be done on an organizational, but the analogy is generally done based on sort of nations. And if you think about a constitution, it can be thought of as capturing a natural or supreme law or capturing a foundational political consensus that in turn prescribes the basis for governance in a society or organization and establishes the basic or fundamental law from which all other laws are derived. So if you pick up in particular the first part of this, the foundational political consensus needs to be captured in any nation. It also probably needs to be captured in the community of all the people who are involved in financial reporting. And so we need to capture some fundamental principles for this consensus to have the widespread acceptance that the IFRS now enjoy. It also picks up this idea of a basic law from which all other laws are derived. And this allows for kind of a consistent deductive reasoning that presumes that the fundamental laws in the Constitution are sufficiently robust and clear to guide. So, two things to make a Constitution work, and this is where the analogy breaks down a little bit, the direct analogy, is you specify the institutions and processes of decision-making. And a lot of that in a Constitution, and it basically says who makes the laws, how do you pass them, what transparency do you need, what time limits does something have to be out there for people to comment, all those things. Those things we put in our due process handbook and not in the conceptual framework. And the prescription of procedure is an essential part, and if we are to be legitimate, you have to have legitimate processes. So we put that in the due process handbook, and if you're really making the analogy, you've got to have both the due process handbook and the conceptual framework. But in terms of influencing the substantive content of the laws and norms, that part's in the conceptual framework. That's the part where you lay out your fundamental principles, that common sort of understanding that's going to set the bounds for debate and set the bounds for achieving agreement across all our stakeholders. So we put that in the conceptual framework. It guides from first principles, it sets the boundaries, and it helps also with setting the boundaries for accounting choice. So conceptual framework but it's a nice analogy. It is a nice way to think of things, especially in a place where you've got a series of stakeholders that you have to be, in some sense, seeking a broad democratic consensus for what you do, and it helps form the basis for finding that consensus. So, if we go now, I think Andrew's going to talk a little bit more about principles.
Yes, and in particular, I want to contrast principles and rules. I think it's fair to say that, as Tom has already indicated, that principles really are the fundament. They're at a very high level. They don't necessarily solve all the accounting issues you can think about, but they do represent a distillation of what is really the essence of good accounting. Therefore, they rather lead rather than prescribe. They tell you where you want to get to or indicate the path to where you might like to get to, but they don't prescribe exactly what it is that should be done. And that makes them perhaps easy to dismiss, but that would be, I think, a huge mistake. They've got to be seen as something that actually leads to judgment, that one needs to balance them. Sometimes there can be tension between various parts of a conceptual framework. For example, sometimes one solution will give you more relevance and another will give you more representational faithfulness, and you have to judge where you come down on that. And rules are more or less the flip side of that. Rules tell you exactly what you have to do. And that's kind of comfortable if, for example, you don't want to be sued as a result of improperly preparing financial statements. But they're very much a focus on regulating people, telling them exactly what they have to do, and they result in a compliance mentality, so that the preparation of financial statements, whether it's by management or with the cooperation of their auditors, simply becomes an exercise in checking that all the rules have been complied with, and then you can rest easy. In defense of rules, I would note that rules can be quite handy if you know precisely what judgment or decision is going to be made on the basis of that information. For example, if you want to know what somebody's tax liability is, then you need fairly detailed prescribed rules, and then you can say, well, the tax bill for this year is so much, and everybody can agree. If you want to know whether somebody's breached a debt covenant, then the debt agreement needs to set out in some detail precisely how that's going to be judged. But I don't think that financial reporting should have such a modest aim. The conceptual framework sets out the objective of reporting, which is for making a wide range of decisions by a wide range of people. And that's not just about valuing the shares. It's about anything that an investor might want to know. How well is this company managing its working capital, for example? You just can't put any limit on the kind of questions that informed and curious investors, or indeed other stakeholders, are going to seek to be answered from the financial statements. And that seems to me is a very strong justification for having principles rather than a rigid set of rules. It's not all about earnings per share. So, taking that on, we have a system which helps resolve accounting issues primarily for standard setters, but also for practitioners. If they're in a novel situation, which do come around, there may be no guidance in accounting standards. They can have regard to the conceptual framework to try to figure out what might be a reasonable kind of solution. And hopefully the use of the framework will lead to much greater consistency, but also to shorter standards. Because they're based on clear principles, one doesn't need to explain all their implications or how they would apply in every recondite circumstance. And finally, and I think this is something I personally feel passionate about, only if we have principled accounting standards can we really say that we're members of a thinking profession, a profession that deserves the name because it makes use of accumulated experience, the exercise of personal judgment, and is not merely the application of mechanical rules, which, as we hear increasingly from day to day, can sooner or later be done with an iPhone. So, Tom, do we have an ideal conceptual framework?
So, that's one question people often ask, and on the right is sort of the ideal. If you think about what appears on the right, which the answer is no, but it doesn't hurt to stop and think about what ideal would look like, and you would sort of have a world where you would develop your fundamental principles in the conceptual framework. And to some degree, these laws or principles almost have to be self-evident from the very beginning if you're to do it in a purely ideal sense. Then, in this ideal world, consistent standards would flow from the conceptual framework. And they would have to be consistent because the concepts came first and then the standards followed. And then practice would reflect the standards. And to the degree that there was any kind of a gap, management policy choices would go back to conceptual framework and reflect the same principles. And it would kind of work like that. And it would be a purely deductive approach, if you think about that sort of thing. The reality that we've jumped into, and everybody who comes to financial reporting or accounting or standard setting gets to jump into this flowing historical stream. So historically, practice evolved across separate national environments. Over time, there was some pressure to write these things down, and you had national standards develop. Then there was some pressure to help justify the standards because they were often found to be inconsistent, and so conceptual frameworks started to get written, often as the result of some sort of an economic crisis. Then, as the world globalized, accounting and financial reporting did as well, and we had international standards developing along with an international conceptual framework. And then lastly, we need to understand that this is an iterative process. Mutual influence, conceptual framework, standards, and practice. And it's what we now have is sort of an inductive-deductive. They initially took the what was in practice, and they inductively reached standards, inductively sort of thought what those principles ought to be, and then deductively influenced the next set of standards, the next set of practice, and we've been running this inductive-deductive game now for probably since at least the Great Depression. And each time through, though, I think we refine our ideas and we get a little bit better. And I think the conceptual framework becomes more complete, precise, cohesive, and the standards become more complete, precise, and cohesive as well. So we don't have an ideal, but we're constantly striving for that. And so, Andrew, with what we do have, conceptual framework in place, how is it helping?
Thanks, Tom. So far, I think we've been largely, not totally, but we've been largely sort of, in a sense, theoretical. We've said, well, these are all the reasons why one might suppose that a framework would be a good thing to have. But I think all of that could justifiably be questioned unless we get into when the rubber hits the road, how does it actually help, and in particular, how does it help standard setting? Now, we can hint at that this morning, but fortunately, we're not the only session today on the conceptual framework. Later on today, the rubber really will hit the road because you'll have to apply the conceptual framework to some case studies, and hopefully that will reinforce whatever we say now. First point I think Tom's already covered, but it's worth reinforcing, and I think I probably mentioned it earlier as well. If we have a conceptual framework, it is not sufficient for a standard setter merely to say, well, this seems like a good answer, or this is something we are comfortable with. It really requires a rigorous thought process to demonstrate that the proposed solution does conform to the fundamental principles. And sometimes, as Tom suggested, developing a new standard will suggest ways in which the framework is incomplete and needs to be supplemented. It also sets the boundaries. We have the objective for financial reporting. So if somebody says, well, this accounting standard is going to be terribly inconvenient because it will make us pay more tax, for example, or if they've got other reasons for objecting to a standard, you can say, well, hold on, is this all about, in a nutshell, informing investors, or is it simply for the private interest of your particular constituents or whatever? Consistency is, of course, a major prize. The idea that standards should reflect a common worldview and hopefully contribute to a coherent set of financial statements which are more understandable and easier to interpret than those that sometimes prioritize the balance sheet and sometimes prioritize the P&L on whatever grounds. If you've got inconsistent standards too, there are opportunities for structuring transactions so that they can fall under whichever standard gives the more favorable treatment. But it's not just about consistency, it's also about quality. And I think standard setters should, and indeed largely do, have a privileged kind of position in the world because of the expectation that is placed on them. It's not just standardization for the sake of standardization and consistency, nice though that is. It's also about improving the quality of financial reporting. That makes them very different to other kinds of standard setters, I think. I mean, some of you will have noticed that in this country we drive on the left. Well, it sort of works for us. And it doesn't really matter that in other countries they drive on the right. If you think about standardization for things like electricity or mobile phones, precisely what the standard is doesn't really matter very much, as long as everybody agrees what it is, at least within one nation and ideally internationally. But accounting standard setting isn't like that. It's not just about one common solution, nationally or globally. It's about getting to the best solution. And so one of the major contributions of the conceptual framework is to say, well, what counts as being better? It can actually provide a direction because it tells you what the objective is. It tells you what are the characteristics that information has if it's to contribute to those objectives. So in that way, it's perhaps not a surprise that, as far as I know, and how would I know, electrical regulators probably don't have a conceptual framework as such, but accounting standard setters, because they have loftier ambitions, because of what's been entrusted to them to do, absolutely need one. Just to become a bit more back to the real world, if you're thinking about an accounting solution and you want to test it against the framework, there are a number of questions that you have to think about. I've only put a few of them on the slide, but these are, some would say, some of the key ones. Think about, for example, suppose we didn't have a standard that told you how to account for the liability to restore a mine. But your question is, well, once you've dug a bit of a mine, should you now recognize a liability, or is it okay to wait 30 or 40 years until the mine is actually discontinued? If you think that one of the questions the framework makes you ask is, well, is there a liability there? Does it conform with the definition? I'm not going to argue the toss one way or the other, but I just point out that is a fundamental question. Then you've got to ask, does it meet the recognition criteria? Including, is measurement reliable? Does this information actually help anybody? What's the appropriate measurement basis? As I would put it, do you want an entry value or an exit value? Do you want a historic measurement? Or do you want something that's current? And what does that do? And the IASB framework, I think, is now much clearer on this. It's not just about the balance sheet, but also about its effect on the reported financial performance. If you use that measurement basis, what income and expenses arrive? And how is that income and expense to be best presented and disclosed in the financial statement? So there are a number of issues, and perhaps I'll leave I've left till last the key one, which is, how does this proposed solution help meet the objective of financial reporting? So with that, I'll pass to Tom to conclude.
So I think in concluding, we'll go to the quote, the status and purpose. And there are sort of three things in paragraph SP 1.1, if you wanted to go read it. The first two are almost verbatim. The third's more of a paraphrasing. But the first one, and most people see this as most important, is to provide guidance to standard setters on considerations relevant to selecting accounting methods and disclosures. And that's generally seen as the most important one. It's fundamentally what provides the coherence and the consistency.
Sorry. Did you get any of the... No, I'll repeat that.
Sorry.
No, anyways, who knows? Anyway, sorry. So just come back. So these are pulled from the status and purpose. And the first two are verbatim, and the third one's a paraphrase. But the first one, which is provide guidance to standard setters on considerations relevant to selecting accounting methods and disclosures, this is generally seen as the most important one because it provides coherence and consistency to all the standards. And we've sort of described how it does this, whether you analogize to a constitution or whether you think about principles, the deductive approach, all those things. The second one, though, is really kind of interesting. It helps to maintain the coherence and consistency because if you're a preparer and you don't have a clear path to go to, it directs you back to where those fundamental principles are located. And I think one of the neat things about this is that going back to our first thing about it being principles-based, this is almost a necessary condition for it to be principles-based. The preparers can actually go back there. If they were unable to be principles-based, what you would then have to do is set up a system where every time there was something confusing, it would have to go shooting in for an almost immediate view from somebody in some position of authority, and you would have an ongoing system of interpretations and things which would, I think, sort of move you toward rules, because every individual circumstance would come in and be dealt with sort of as an individual thing. And while they might look to the principles, the individual circumstance would tend to dominate. So I think the second one is really important. And then the third one is, because we are a community, and even going back to the due process, that we have all these, it's a shared effort to set standards. And the conceptual frameworks where we look for sort of some common language and some boundaries. But it really enhances the discussion among all of us, among all stakeholders. And it also does a really important job in enhancing the education of accountants. If you didn't have a principles-based system and you sort of ended up with something where somebody just wrote, here's how you do X, you would just have a series of rules and people would memorize them. And as Andrew said, if you really want to be part of an educated and true profession, then it has to involve judgment. And so again, having conceptual framework and building standards that way, we think, is not only really good for standard setting and financial reporting, it's also good for a thriving accounting profession. And that's it. Now we have, we'll have detail, first of all, at 1:30, and an opportunity for questions right now.
So in terms of questions, we did receive a number of questions, and please send more in if you want using Slido. So the first one is to do with this idea of the conceptual framework as a constitution. And the question is, how do you reconcile the idea of the conceptual framework as a constitution with the fact that the board is permitted to override aspects of the conceptual of the conceptual framework?
So it's funny. It was interesting that the FASB coined it, because if you looked across a whole series of countries and their constitutions, probably the U.S. Constitution is more prominent on average than, say, the constitutions of other countries, and at least more prominent in the minds of citizens. However, not if you do the analogy, many national constitutions provide for exceptions and overrides, sometimes with limited amounts of time. And there's an acknowledgement about where you are and how perfect this constitution is. And so there's a judgment when you create a constitution. And in the US case, they made it pretty dominant. But in many other countries, they don't. And in our case, if we go back to that history, and you think about how it evolved, that all these things were out there before we even tried to write it down, it would have been really heroic to say, we can now write down something that's going to govern perfectly for all time, especially when we have differing economic circumstances. So I think it's completely reasonable to use the Constitution as an analogy and learn what you can. And even, as I said, you can use, nations have constitutions that allow for exceptions. In an ideal world, if you had that perfect constitution, yeah, that would be nice. But we're evolving, and there's going to be more efforts at this as the economy changes and we evolve.
Could I just slightly add to that by noting that the IESB has very clearly said that whenever a new standard conflicts with the framework, it will signal that in the standard, which I think is totally laudable. Personally, I would have urged the IESB to go further and say that invariably in every standard, it should discuss how that new standard relates to the framework. But nonetheless, it is reassuring to know that departures will be clearly explained and discussed, and that will feed into, I imagine, discussions about whether the framework should be revised in the sort of iterative way that Tom outlined earlier.
Thank you. Next question is actually about the use of the conceptual framework. And it says, the effective use of the conceptual framework is a function of both a culture of commitment and training. How does the ISB instill that culture and educate new board and staff?
I think it's just what we're doing today. I think it's a fundamental part of every accounting or financial person's education is to understand the conceptual framework and how it relates. And as Andrew just said, I think we can improve that by writing more frequently and clearly exactly when there's departures, not only departures, but first, why does the standard relate? How does it relate? And because I think going forward, as we go through this iterative process, I think the conceptual framework will get stronger and stronger and be more and more critical in education.
I think just to add from me, as because I'm a member of the IB staff, and I can say for all of us probably, that we are being very much educated on the conceptual framework. We had personal development sessions on it, but I think the best part of our education is when our board members have now started asking us, what does the conceptual framework say about this or that aspect of your paper? Which means that we have to be able to apply it now. So that is going to flow through. The next question is, if the conceptual framework and education on the conceptual framework is so important, should it be part of the accounting education taught to accounting students?
In my view, it is more important. I mean, particularly, I guess the way education is organized varies very much between different countries. But certainly at university level, as opposed to professional level in this country, I think it's more important that students are taught how to think about accounting by learning the conceptual framework and learning it critically, as all proper learning should be. That's much more important than learning what IAS 12 teaches you about deferred tax. In fact, I feel particularly strongly about IAS 12 and deferred tax, but I'll leave that discussion for another day. I just can't imagine how you can have a proper profession where people haven't really learned to think things through, and I don't know how they can do that unless, as I say, they have learned the conceptual framework, but I mean that not in the sense of memorizing it, but critically evaluating it.
Thank you. The next question, again, is about applying the conceptual framework, and now from the standard standard setter's point of view. So there are obviously areas of accounting like financial performance reporting and FIES where standard setters have been struggling to develop guidance for quite a while now. And the question is this in part because the conceptual framework maybe is not as developed in some areas as it is in others?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's very much the case, as I think Tom tried to brought out very well, that there is an iterative process. If we tried to write a conceptual framework that answered every accounting issue, we'd never have got the job done, and probably the job never will be done. What we've got today, as of March, is a huge step forward, but it's not the end of the road, and there will always be issues where there's gaps, where there's room for improvement. Perhaps we could learn more from standards into the framework than we do at the moment. I'm not sure about that, but that certainly might. I don't think just because it doesn't answer every issue one should say, well, therefore, the framework's not, a waste of time. I think that would be a huge mistake.
Yeah, and just to link it in on this evolution, and I'll do, first of all, the primary financial statements project was financial performance was mentioned. I think that's one of the places where when the initial iterations, there was a lot of emphasis on assets and liabilities and as the fundamental building blocks, and then we use changes to get to revenues or income and expenses. And we keep evolving, and I think one of the things this version, and you guys will talk about it later, is we made big strides forward in saying things about how to measure, and we made big strides forward in being clearer about OCI, and I think those were big steps, and so I think the conceptual framework is helping us, and it's helping us with that project, with the, also with the basic underlying idea of representational faithfulness and relevancy. So we're keeping those things in mind, and we're getting better advice, and now in the standard we're going to take that advice and refine the standard to hopefully pull out, or on primary financial statements, to pull out even better information for people. So again, iterative, and the FICE one I'll leave alone because that's a little bit, having mentioned it, is FICE we actually consciously say it may do things that may cause us to rethink the conceptual framework, it may not, because there are gray areas. So we did our fundamental building blocks of assets and liabilities, and equity is the derivative of those A minus L. And so even there, we are going to maybe do some refining, because again, it's incomplete and it's evolving.
Thank you. Now thinking about it from the sort of more prepared point of view, by being a constitution, what will be the position of accountant in balancing the nation jurisdictional requirements and the conceptual framework requirements?
Well, I believe there's a hierarchy, and I always get confused as whether it's IS1 or IS8, because I never can remember which is in each standard. But there is a hierarchy set out, and somewhere in that, it tells you in what order to consider things, and I'm not going to fall into the temptation of trying to recall exactly what the order is, because I'd probably get it wrong and embarrass myself. Obviously, if there are national requirements, then presumably, if they're legally enforceable, then people have to comply with them. But if they do, and that means that they depart from IFRS, having taken account of the hierarchy, then they cannot make the unreserved statement of compliance with IFRS that is required by IFRS.
Another question is about principles sort of versus rules. Is it right to think that we need the conceptual framework because IFRS is principle-based? Do we need it at all in a rule-based scheme as well?
I'll try and have a go at that. It seems to me that if you've got a rule-based system, you don't actually need very much of a conceptual framework at all. I mean, the rules will be unsatisfactory and arbitrary, and some people will feel aggrieved. But I still think one needs an overriding policy objective if those rules are to be regarded as fair. You could say that in that environment, I'm thinking about, for example, circumstances, as I mentioned, where rules are established to work out what somebody's tax liability is, or their entitlement to benefits. And we've had certainly a couple of cases have cropped up in the UK fairly recently where people have said, I'm not entitled to this benefit because of this arbitrary rule. You know, I lived with this person for 30 years, but we weren't married, and now I find I can't get benefits and so on. So I think one, even in a rule-based system, one would need some kind of overriding policy objective if the rules were to be regarded as anything other than arbitrary.
So, yeah, I think if you had, and I'll go back to that ideal world, the deductive part in this deductive-inductive thing that we do, you can't do the deductive part without a conceptual framework, without principles. And almost invariably, what you're going to get out of that is sort of local circumstance and time and the people involved, they'll write something. And it'll be different than a different local circumstance, time, and a different set of people. And what that'll look like after a while, even if they had some principles in their mind when they did it at the time, over time it's going to look like a set of arbitrary rules because there won't be any coherence. So you have to have a conceptual framework to have a principles-based system. It, in my view, and I won't go too far with this, is I don't actually, some people see them, and the SEC did a big giant paper a few years ago where they put rules at one end and principles at the other. I personally don't really see it like that. I think you can have principles, and then you can put in some rules as long as they are consistent with the principle, you would still be principles based. So you could have a principle and you decide that for some reason you need real clarity on something and you put in some rule, maybe a bright line or whatever. The danger, of course, with those things is it's very hard to write the rule so it's completely coherent with the principle. And if you fail to do that, then you start getting back into what I think people perceive as rules-based systems. So I see them as a little bit different, serving different purposes, but rules have in them the danger of eroding principles if they're used carelessly.
One more question, and this is more to do with sort of the conceptual comparison of the conceptual framework with the FASB framework. Can we comment maybe on the differences between the two?
No.
All I will say is that I don't claim to be up to speed with where the FASB are, but I've been quite encouraged by some of what I've seen on their website.
There's another question that is probably even more difficult to answer. It's about our changing world. More and more jobs are being overtaken by robots rather than humans. Is the ISB doing anything in that regard? And should the conceptual framework be start something that we should be starting with?
I think, well, Nili and folks earlier were talking about the role of technology, and certainly it's something to think about. But if you go back to the definitions we had up there earlier, these are coherent, logical systems, and whether it's being applied by a robot or a human, you still need a coherent logical system. So I don't think technology is a great threat to the need for a conceptual framework, although exactly how we use it and how the profession is going to evolve, fortunately Nili and a lot of our folks are thinking really hard about this, and we should hopefully keep abreast with the times.
Yeah, if I could just amplify, I think one of the most important things that accountants do, and you know, this debate on technology is not a new idea that you might be able to sort of log into every company's database and see every transaction. That's not going to necessarily help the user because he still needs information which is classified and aggregated. You can give him the text of every lease agreement, but he wants to know how big the liability is. And that's what accountants do. Accountants say, look, we've been through all these leases. That's the liability. And by the way, it's rather like debt, so we'll add it to the debt as well, if that provides helpful information to users. So I'm often think that perhaps I'm on one side of the spectrum, but I think the extent to which technology will replace accounting, and certainly judgmental thinking accounting, is sometimes much overstated.
Now, a question more practical. Is the conceptual framework applicable to IFRS for SMEs, that is small and medium enterprises? And do you want to answer?
I'm sure there are people in the room who know far more about this than I do, but I think the IFRS for SME contains a sort of condensed version of the framework, presumably the 2010 framework at the moment, rather than the later one. And that is what I am guessing people who comply with the IFRS for SMEs have to have regard to.
Yeah, that's right. There is a distinct but related conceptual framework for the SMEs.
I just gave the high sign to Yelena to suggest that we start wrapping up this session. If everybody can pull out their phones, tablets, laptops, I think we'll move in a minute to evaluations. Before we do, I have a couple of admin points. I want to give a chance to Andrew and to Tom for any last words if there's something that didn't fit into a Q&A response. But before either of those things happened, I'd like to introduce Yelena, who snuck up on stage. She wasn't advertised for this session, but only for the one after lunch. So let me do a catch-up on the introduction of her. Yelena, my notes don't say how long ago you joined the ISB.
4.5 years. And
and she has been working on that project since then. She comes originally from, trained in and worked in Lithuania, she can fly under your radar screen as she can be kind of a quiet personality, but what you find out when you work with her, very thoughtful, very knowledgeable, and wonderful at pulling together lots of material, as you will see this afternoon when we do the breakout sessions on conceptual frameworks. So delighted that she could join here. Now, let me turn to maybe Andrew first and Tom to see if there are any last words you want to offer.
I think the only thing I would want to say, and sort of modesty forbids because I did play a small part in it myself, but I just think that despite all our reservations at the outset of this round of revisions of the framework, I think it's been a remarkable achievement and reflects extremely well on ISB and those people who brought it to this stage. It's not perfect, it never will be, but nonetheless, I really want to congratulate the ISB for it.
Yeah, it's funny just what Andrew said. I've heard some people, they'll go and pick some issue that it doesn't seem to solve and say it's awful. I'm a much more of a glass half full or quarter full person, and I think these are really significant improvements, and I just kind of Andrew and I were asked to sort of get together and talk at a high level about why you would want to have a conceptual framework. But the next session, the staff are going to bring on the current set of improvements, and I think they're significant. I think you'll find them really interesting, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you think when we get to the breakout session. So thank you very much.
Okay, let's. Now, again, a few admin items. First of all, Gloria is going to bring up the evaluations for the session. We're asking you for the same kind of input in terms of your view about quality, usefulness, etc. So, if I can ask you to just work through them, and Gloria, if you would click over from question to question as we cross over about the 50 mark, that would be good. The second thing falls into the category as do as I say, not as I do. The reason I say that is because I have been beaten by Christina to encourage you, if you are a social media user and you want to tweet or otherwise communicate about the session that you're at, to do so using the hashtag that was used for Slido sign-on, the hashtag IFRS_WSS. Third, and a piece of data that's for your convenience in the back, we've set up a couple of charging stations for your devices if you need that. Our lunch will be downstairs in the Forum restaurant, and we'll be upstairs starting again here with another plenary session at 1:30. Now, here's your motivation for showing up on time. The session we do after that is breakout working groups where we're going to ask you to put your standard setter's hat on and try and work through some of the issues that we're wrestling with now using just the conceptual framework to reason your way through. And that might be in part an answer to the issue that I think Andrew addressed about how much could we automate application of the conceptual framework. You might find it interesting to see if your group comes to the same or different views about a session. I also am going to ask once again if either you haven't responded about whether you're attending dinner or if you've responded but your answer has changed, to please make sure you let Carol and or Min at the front at the registration desk know about that. And then are we through? Okay, then we have one more question, and since it's not quite 12:30, which is when we're breaking, I might see if Gloria is able to then flip us to the two questions we didn't get to this morning when we had IT connection issues. And if you do have any comments on the presentation, please then either send them here, or if you let us know by email, that would be great. Thank you. So Gloria, can you go back to session this morning? Now, we had a question about whether the breakout sessions are going to be filmed. I think we are experimenting with filming of sessions at the conference, and I'm watching Michelle's face to see if she gives me thumbs up or thumbs down. We haven't decided whether or not, you know, we're going to wait till we see how well it works as a recording to determine whether or not we release or use pieces of the breakout sessions. The only ones we are recording are the ones in this room, so we are not recording all of them. So you are going to have to make your hard choices for 2 out of 5 in terms of which ones you pick up, but we will be in touch about if we make any of the information from the breakout sessions recording available more widely. Okay. Gloria, I don't know, can we go back to the two that we missed this morning? People have been answering them, which is great. And one reason I wanted to get to them before we went much further is because we do want to do, if we skip to the next one, because we do want to do a before and after in terms of how well your expectations are realized. So if we can get the before without much more time going past, that would be great. So question 4. This is the one that's really important, I think, to get your feedback in, and then you'll see it again at the end of the conference.